While the pros shake their heads in disbelief, Donald Trump focuses on the cons. It gets more surreal every day on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. The conventions are over and the two parties have had their say.
Never have I heard language like this from both camps. Yeah, of course you expect heated rhetoric, but for Donald Trump to call Hillary Clinton the devil, it'll be interesting to see if Donald Trump can get rehinged and get back on message and focus about what his message is.
And what to make of their acceptance speeches?
They both kind of tried to show respect for the office. You know, they tried to show humility a little bit. It's not natural for Donald Trump to do that. And so I think if I were judging, I would say that Hillary Clinton came off as more presidential.
There were a lot of Trumps and Clintons on the podium last month, but there's no reason why we can't go back a bit and talk about the Tafts.
My dad was the U.S. Senator, and I remember him campaigning for the nomination. I hit the campaign trail for Dad, so I feel very fortunate to be part of a family that has a long career of public service, and I certainly enjoyed the opportunity to serve as governor of Ohio.
That's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 139 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. The purpose of a national political convention is to celebrate and unite the party. But there were clear signs of disunity out of both Cleveland and Philadelphia. For the Republicans, there was evidence of angry Never Trump delegates on the floor being denied a choice. There was a defiant Ted Cruz in prime time, refusing to endorse his party's nominee. For the Democrats, there was the embarrassment of the WikiLeaks email dump and the forced resignation of DNC chair Debbie Wasserman Schultz. There were supporters of Bernie Sanders still not convinced that Hillary Clinton represented the change they were seeking, even if Bernie and others told them the fight was over. But when all was said and done, the Democrats seemed to be in a better position of being unified. For all her blemishes and faults, Clinton zoomed out of Philly energized and raring to go. She and her party's House, Senate, and gubernatorial candidates seem to be on the same page. That's not the case with the GOP. Donald Trump's decision to pick a fight with a Muslim family who criticized him at the Democratic convention has created a firestorm that, at least as of now, has yet to go away. It started Thursday in Philadelphia when Khizr Khan, accompanied by his wife, was at the platform addressing the delegates. His son, Humayun, was a U.S. Army soldier killed in Iraq by a suicide bomber as he was trying to protect his own troops.
As patriotic American Muslims with undivided loyalty to our country, like many immigrants, we came to this country empty-handed. We believed in American democracy, that with hard work and goodness of this country, we could share in and contribute to its blessings. We are blessed to raise our three sons in a nation where they were free to be themselves and follow their dreams.
Soon, it became more political.
Hillary Clinton was right when she called my son the best of America. If it was up to Donald Trump, he never would have been in America. Donald Trump consistently smears the character of Muslims. He disrespects other minorities, women, judges, even his own party leadership. he vows to build walls and ban us from this country. Donald Trump, you're asking Americans to trust you with their future. Let me ask you, have you even read the United States Constitution? I will gladly lend you my copy.
It was a stinging attack on the Republican nominee. And as whenever he's attacked, Donald Trump fights back. Here he is on ABC's This Week with host George Stephanopoulos.
I saw him. He was, very emotional and probably looked like a nice guy to me. His wife, if you look at his wife, she was standing there. She had nothing to say. Maybe she wasn't allowed to have anything to say. You tell me, but plenty of people have written that.
He said, "You have sacrificed nothing and no one."
Well, that sounds, who wrote that? Did Hillary's scriptwriters write it?
How would you answer that, Father? What sacrifice have you made for your country?
I think I've made a lot of sacrifices. I work very, very hard. I've created thousands and thousands of jobs, tens of thousands of jobs, built great structures. I've had tremendous success. I think
those
I've
are
done
sacrifices.
A lot. Oh, sure. I think they're sacrifices. I think when I can employ thousands and thousands of people, take care of their education, take care of so many things, even in military. I mean, I was very responsible, along with a group of people, for getting the Vietnam Memorial built in downtown Manhattan, which to this day people thank me for. I have raised millions of dollars for the vets. I'm helping the vets a lot. I think my popularity with the vets is through the roof, far greater than hers. She's done nothing. All she's done is tell everybody that the vets are in good shape, they're fine, and they're not fine. People are waiting online for 7 days to see a doctor. She thinks it's fine.
The spat has not died down. The cons have continued their assault on Trump through interviews on network and cable news programs. For his part, while Trump has called their son a hero, he continues to lash back at the con family for their attacks. At a rally in Reno, Nevada, vice presidential candidate Mike Pence, whose son is serving in the Marines, was asked a question about the controversy. The questioner was booed after her remarks.
Having spent time with our nominee, I have never been around someone more devoted to the armed forces of this country, more devoted to the families of our soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marine, and Coast Guard, and no one more devoted to the veterans in this country. Donald Trump supports our soldiers and supports our veterans like no other leader in my lifetime.
But other Republicans, including Senator John McCain and House Speaker Paul Ryan, have condemned the remarks, even though they have not rescinded their support for the nominee. And, perhaps not coincidentally, Trump, in a Washington Post interview on Tuesday, said he at this time cannot endorse Ryan, the GOP's top elected official, in his primary contest in Wisconsin next week, nor would he back McCain in his August 30th primary. And he singled out New Hampshire Senator Kelly Ayotte as, quote, weak and disloyal. The Republican Party has had its spats over the years. There was no shortage of speakers, such as Michigan Governor George Romney, who warned against extremism at the 1964 GOP convention.
And had Lincoln ignored the know-nothing extremists of his day, he would not have been president of the United States and saved the nation.
But it's hard to recall a presidential candidate who has attacked members of his own party seeking re-election. The conventions are over. Now it's time for this week's trivia question. I've been saving this one for a while. Who was the last presidential candidate who had the lead in delegates going into the convention but failed to win his or her party's nomination? Send your answer to trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll give you the answer to our last trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
He's got high hopes. He's got high hopes. He's got high apple pie in the sky. I hope so.
time you're getting low, instead of letting go, just remember that ant. Oops, there goes another rubber tree plant.
Oops, there goes another rubber tree plant.
Oops, there goes another rubber tree plant.
The best way to get a sense of what's going on at the conventions is by talking with the delegates who were there, in person, about the issues that matter to them. And that's just what we did over the past 2 weeks in Cleveland and Philadelphia. If you miss them, I hope you get to listen to our last two shows, recorded on the scene from both conventions. But now that we're back, I'm especially interested in reviewing it all with Neil Conan, the former host of Talk of the Nation, who's a political junkie guest, the first show of every month. Neil, once again, we have a lot to talk about. How you doing?
Ken, I have to stop you. I need to watch TV.
You have to watch TV? Well, wait a second. Now, for those who don't get that, this is Donald Trump during an interview. He paused in the middle of an interview to watch TV.
Five times he paused in the middle of an interview with the Washington Post.
Well, you know something? The Washington Post interview, which was, I guess, Tuesday of this week, this is what's so remarkable. So he wins the nomination. It's not the most unified party in the world. You had Ted Cruz on the podium basically refusing to endorse Donald Trump. There still remains a lot of Never Trump delegates who were angry, who were there in Cleveland. But you think once you get the nomination, it's your party. You go on to unite the party. And yet in that Washington Post interview, tell me exactly what he said. This is just mind-boggling.
He said he was asked if he was endorsing Paul Ryan, who's up in a primary up in Wisconsin. And he said, you know, I'm not there yet, which were, of course, the exact words that Paul Ryan used before he endorsed Donald Trump. He said he would not endorse John McCain, who's up in a primary, and he would not support Kelly Ayotte, who he said has given him no support whatsoever. All three have endorsed him.
I mean, if you think of what Hillary Clinton did, one of the first things she said at the convention in Philadelphia was a big shout out to Bernie Sanders. Now, Bernie Sanders didn't seem so happy at the convention.
I don't think Bernie Sanders has been happy since the Brooklyn Dodgers won the pennant.
Well, I haven't been either. And besides, the Yankees got rid of everybody.
I know, it's amazing.
Basically, the Yankees getting rid of everybody reminds me of what Donald Trump is doing. The Yankees clearly don't want to win, and I'm not convinced Donald Trump wants to win. So at the convention in Philadelphia, Hillary Clinton, you know, clearly a shout out to Bernie Sanders and her support and his supporters who are not too happy. Donald Trump refuses to do any kind of shout out to his own Republicans.
And his speech, if it's interesting, yes, he continues to alienate his members, senior members of his own party, who are, if they're still endorsing him, are doing it through clenched teeth. But then go back to that speech that he gave, which, if you paraphrase Hobbes, was nasty, brutish, and long, and it directed strictly to his base, which are angry white men with less than a college degree. This was no reach out to anybody else at all. I just thought, didn't you think that was remarkable?
I did. And basically, it sounded like a speech he's given at every rally up to the convention. I mean, you know, his anger, his unhappiness with the status quo and the Obama administration and Hillary's lies. But it just sounded like word for word what we've heard at almost every rally, except he didn't tell a baby to shut up. But other than that, it sounded like the same.
They just keep on coming, don't they? It was more under control because he was reading off a teleprompter and therefore less spontaneous. Therefore, I thought less interesting. And there were scheduling mistakes during the Republican convention. There were some good speeches. I thought particularly good speech by Ivanka Trump introducing her father. But in general, I would have described it as a shambles. What did you think?
Well, were you upset when Melania Trump began her story, a speech with 47 years ago? Was that a mistake?
That was, again, it was not a bad speech until we found out it wasn't bad because she cribbed it.
Yeah. Isn't it remarkable that Michelle Obama had a speech in both the Republican and Democratic conventions?
And she'll have a speech at the next Republican convention because her one this year was a crackerjack.
You know, what's been going on, obviously, since the conventions is Donald Trump's feud with the Kahn family. Look, that was a pretty brutal assault on Trump from the Kahn family, who lost their son, a U.S. Army soldier, who gave his life to protect his fellow soldiers. But Couldn't Donald Trump have just said, look, you know, I may disagree with you, I may disagree with your conclusion, but I honor your son's sacrifice, and he died in a war that I opposed from the beginning. Instead, he keeps this going on. He said, well, they attacked me first, so as soon as I get out of recess, I'm going to attack them back. I mean, it's so 9-year-old behavior.
I think you're demeaning 9-year-olds. Look, there is a formula for this. Hillary Clinton was attacked by the mother of one of the soldiers who got killed in Benghazi at the Republican convention. And what she said was, I'm heartbroken for your loss and everybody honors his service. This is exactly what President George W. Bush said when he was attacked by Cindy Sheehan during the Iraq War. It's not hard. It's what you do. There is no benefit to attacking a Gold Star family. And he continues to go back at it. And this has people in the Republican Party tearing their hair out, not just the people he wouldn't endorse, but it's Meg Whitman and Richard Hanna, a retiring congressman from upstate New York, who have now said they will vote for Hillary Clinton. And there's a couple of important advisors, Sally Bradshaw, who used to work for Jeb Bush, and Maria Camella, who used to work for Chris Christie. I think she might still work for Chris Christie. And she's going to vote for Hillary Clinton, too.
Well, she said she'd cross that bridge when she comes to it.
if she can get through the traffic.
I love that little hesitation in your laugh, so I'm happy now. You know something? I mean, this is another thing. I was also thinking of the convention, of the difference in convention, the people who didn't show in Cleveland and those who did show in Philadelphia.
Absolutely. You had, at the Democratic convention, you had a TV appearance from Jimmy Carter, from President Carter. You had, obviously, President Clinton was there. Obviously, President Obama was there. And the only president who will campaign with Donald Trump is Vladimir Putin.
You don't see any, and this is ridiculous, but this is a ridiculous show, but you don't see any possibility that at some time in September or October he says, the heck with it, it's not worth it, I quit?
I didn't until, I think, this week. If the numbers continue to get worse for him, if he's convinced that he would be embarrassed and lose, he may find a way to pull out. There are other people who think, you know, this debate thing is misconstrued, that he does want to go to those debates. But there are those who think, you know, this is a format that Hillary Clinton does particularly well in, and it's a format that Donald Trump might not do particularly well in. It would be a very high-risk appearance for him, so he may be trying to find a way out of that. It didn't work so well for George H.W. Bush when he tried to duck the debates with Bill Clinton, and, you know, you get guys showing up in chicken suits. So, you know, I don't see how he gets out of it, it's possible. When he keeps saying, again, just starting the last few days since the end of the Democratic convention, that the system is rigged, they're going to take this away from us, he could, you know, there's a couple of things about that, one of which is that he says he can say the system is rigged and I'm not going to play this, corrupt game anymore. And that might be the excuse he uses to get out. But the other thing that troubles me so deeply about that, and I wonder if it does you too, is that we've had both presidential candidates essentially delegitimized before Labor Day, Donald Trump supporters are chanting, lock her up. And if Hillary Clinton wins, there will be a substantial fraction of the American electorate who will not consider herself a legitimate president. And if Donald Trump wins, we just had the president of the United States again come out and say he's unfit to serve. It seemed to me the whole Democratic convention, there were some really good speeches at that convention, but the whole Democratic convention was on the idea that, look, Donald Trump is not a conservative. He's not really a Republican. He is a demagogue and we can't elect him. And he's been delegitimized too. It's a terrible problem for whoever wins. Yes, you won the election, but good luck governing.
You know, when I think of the Democratic Convention, I think of how it began. I mean, it was almost a dream come true for the Republicans. They had the release of the Wiki, the release of the DNC emails that WikiLeaks ran with, and that was published. It embarrassed Debbie Wasserman Schultz. She was forced to resign as DNC chair. There are obviously, and there are all these Bernie Sanders supporters saying that we told you so, we told you so. It was rigged. Talking about the word rigged, it was rigged from the beginning. Donald Trump could have theoretically played up on these Democratic divisions. Instead, he's creating he's embroiled in his own stuff, like with the Khan family and with the fellow Republicans, Ryan and McCain.
And don't forget the Purple Heart.
The Purple Heart
well,
that somebody sent
him. He's picking on fire marshals, Ken. Just in the last couple of days, three DNC officials have resigned. This after Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the same thing. Hillary Clinton has gone on TV and made totally unsupported remarks, saying that the FBI director James Comey had found her responses truthful. That's stretching the truth a little bit. She's gone on and talked about how the email hack was definitely Russia. She doesn't know that. I don't know that. Barack Obama doesn't know that. This would be making news, except there is this barrage of unforced errors by Donald Trump.
You and I have been covering presidential politics for a long time. Have you ever, ever, ever seen a race like this, ever?
Never, never. And never have I heard language like this from both camps. Yeah, of course you expect heated rhetoric, but for Donald Trump to call Hillary Clinton the devil, for the president of the United States to say that one of the candidates of the two major parties is unfit to serve, I've never seen anything like this, Ken. Have you?
The answer is no. I've never seen anything like it. I mean, obviously, the party establishment was not thrilled with McGovern in 72 on the Democratic side or Goldwater in 64. But I never saw, especially with somebody like Donald Trump, somebody who would just do whatever he can to stick his finger in the eye, his thumb in the eye of his fellow Republicans, just as he's trying to unite the party in time for November.
Well, it's a long run up to the next touchstone of this campaign season, which is the first debate, which is not until late September.
Right.
It'll be interesting to see if Donald Trump can get rehinged and get back on message and focus about what his message is. But I wanted to ask you, sort of a conventional question about the conventions, Ken. One of the things they are for is obviously to showcase the party. And one of the things they have done in the past is to showcase up-and-coming talent, most famously Barack Obama back in 2004. Did you see anybody at either convention who's the next generation, a rising star?
Well, maybe so. That's interesting about the difference in convention speakers. Of course, the ones I remember on the Republican side, considering the fact that the Bushes and the McCains and the Ayots and the Romneys and everybody else stayed home, even Mike John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, stayed home. You did see a lot of Trump kids. They will be. I'll give you that. And Scott Baio, he'll be probably the next president of the United States. But on the Democratic side, I think a lot of the Democrats who were in the running, yes or no, for vice president, the Cory Bookers, the Julian Castro, Javier's Becerra. There are a lot of up-and-coming Democrats who are to be watched in future, for future cycles, especially given the fact that Hillary Clinton, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders are really in their late 60s, early 70s, and there's really time for a new generation.
I thought Cory Booker did particularly well. I thought that was a well-delivered
speech. He was having such a good time. I ran into him on the floor. Wherever he was just smiling, thumbs up. He's probably having the greatest time. So he's somebody to watch. Neil Conan is a news analyst with Hawaii Public Radio. He's also the former host of Talk of the Nation. And he appears on The Political Junkie, the first show of every month. Next month starts the presidential debates, or the NFL games, whatever's more important to you. And we'll talk to you, Neil, about either one in September.
Good, Ken.
Thanks so much, Neil.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye, so long, farewell. Bye-bye, so long. Seeing you in September. Seeing you when the summer's through.
Here we are, saying goodbye at the stage.
Neil Conan and I were just talking about the selections of Mike Pence and Tim Kaine as the respective Republican and Democratic running mates this year, which brings me to the Political Junkie contest we held back in January. where we invited our readers and listeners to predict the two vice presidential candidates. As it turned out, no one guessed Mike Pence on the GOP side, and a lot predicted Tim Kaine for the Democrats, but it was Matt Miller of Maple Glen, Pennsylvania, who sent in the earliest correct entry. And so, not only does Matt win a genuine Nixon's the One button and bumper sticker from 1968, he also gets to appear on this week's program. Matt, congratulations and welcome to The Political Junkie.
Hi, Ken. Thanks for having me.
Now, I understand you're calling from Dubai.
Yep, I'm in Dubai right now.
Now, I thought people leave the country only when they see who was elected president in November. You left in advance. What's that all about?
Getting an early start, depending on who wins in November.
What's happening in Dubai?
I'm here with an internship.
What kind of stuff do you do there?
I'm with Cellucor, the sports nutrition company, setting up their social media presence here.
So you didn't leave because you were afraid of either Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump being elected?
I was actually afraid of Gary Johnson.
Okay. Tell me, you had Tim Kaine back in January. What made you pick Tim Kaine as a Democratic running mate?
Honestly, I was more thought that the GOP side was going to pick Carly Fiorina because I figured Marco Rubio or somebody would get the nomination. And I just put Tim Kaine as like a generic response because I figured Hillary would pick somebody generic and Tim Kaine fit the bill.
Well, that's exactly what a lot of people, the critics of Tim Kaine, say. It's the safest, most bland choice she made. I mean, he could be a very good choice for a running mate, but that's what a lot of people say, that it was just a very predictable and safe choice.
Yep.
I thought it was very interesting that you picked Carly Fiorina, because had Ted Cruz been the Republican nominee, it would have been Carly Fiorina, and you would have been two for two.
Yeah, his brokerage convention panned out, then I would have gotten them both.
Do you consider yourself a political junkie?
Yeah, I've been listening to his show, I guess, for the past 2 years. Started listening back in high school, and it's my go-to listen on when I run on Thursday mornings, because it'll be up by then, and listen to it then.
You're from Pennsylvania. Obviously, when you come home, you'll be returning to Pennsylvania. It's considered a key state, although we say that every 4 years that Pennsylvania is a key state, and Democrats keep winning it, or at least since 1988. What do you think that's going on right now in Pennsylvania?
I think that this is like the first time that it's actually a legitimate presidential swing state, because every other year past, it's just that pipe dream for the Republicans. But now if you drive through some of the counties that typically, like Lackawanna County and whatnot, that typically go Democrat, all you see is Trump signs. So I guess it'll come down to whether Philadelphia and the collar counties will turn out enough Democrats to offset the big swings in the rest of the state for Trump.
Well, since you won the big political junkie contest and you were the first one to predict Tim Kaine, give me a prediction on who wins Pennsylvania in November.
I think Trump will pull it out. I think that, I don't think Hillary is going to be able to pull out enough votes from Philly and the collar counties to upset Trump's gains everywhere else.
And who wins the election?
Ooh, Trump by a hair. I think Trump will get Florida, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and then the states Romney carried and nothing more.
And you think he wins the presidency? Do you know, if he does win the presidency, do you know that half my audience will join you in Dubai?
Yeah, we get visa-free travel as Americans, so come on over.
Well, Matt Miller is our political junkie winner. He was the first to predict the Democrats would select Tim Kaine for vice president. Congratulations, Matt. It was great talking to you.
Great talking to you, Ken.
It's fun to talk about predicting who will be the next VP, but as is usually the case, the focus is on the top of the ticket. And that was certainly true in Cleveland and Philadelphia. Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. The conventions were about them, and the election will be about them. But before we get into the campaigns, I'd like to focus a bit on the candidates' acceptance speeches. It's usually a good way of getting a sense of what their campaigns hope to accomplish. And nobody's better equipped to talk about candidate rhetoric than Jennifer Murcia, an associate professor of communications at Texas A&M University. Professor Murcia, thank you so much, and welcome to The Political Junkie.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Now, going into the conventions, we knew that Donald Trump likes to speak off the cuff, often in a bombastic and sometimes inflammatory style, while Hillary Clinton is more careful or controlled. Would you say that's a fair assessment of the two of them?
Absolutely. Hillary Clinton is someone who is very controlled, very careful. And some people think that that makes her seem untrustworthy, that they can't sort of look into her soul when she talks, that she doesn't really relate to people the way someone like Joe Biden does. And Donald Trump is sort of the opposite. You sort of feel like you know everything he's thinking. Everything is just stream of consciousness and isn't very well thought out or very well organized.
Obviously, if you're the out party, as Trump is a member of the out party, you try to paint a very negative picture. And of course, if you're the incumbent party, like Hillary Clinton is, and like she's perhaps trying to become an Obama third term, you want to sound optimistic that things are going well. Is that what you heard on in the last couple of weeks at the conventions?
It is what I heard, but I'm not sure if that's the whole story. So if you think about someone like Ronald Reagan in 1980, he was in the out party. He was offering, in fact, a new version of government, so very different from the sort of liberal policies of FDR through Jimmy Carter. But his speech wasn't negative. It was optimistic. Not the case with Donald Trump's speech from 2 weeks ago.
Well, I noticed that, I mean, if you think, you know, you talk about Ronald Reagan talking about morning in America and all the better days ahead of us. And if you think, I'm going to play a little piece of tape from Donald Trump here where it's maybe a fear of the unknown and fear of illegal immigrants. Let me play a little piece of tape.
The number of police officers killed in the line of duty has risen by almost 50% compared to this point last year. Nearly 180,000 illegal immigrants with criminal records ordered deported from our country are tonight roaming free to threaten peaceful citizens. The number of new illegal immigrant families who have crossed the border so far this year already exceeds the entire total from 2015. They are being released by the tens of thousands into our communities with no regard for the impact on public safety or resources.
It was kind of a scary sounding speech, and I heard some delegates at the end yelling, "Build the wall, build the wall." That was not an optimistic speech.
It was not an optimistic speech at all. In fact, I've thought a lot that Donald Trump's political theorist of choice must be Thomas Hobbes. So if your listeners are familiar with Hobbes' Leviathan, they know that he paints a very negative view of the political community, right? The war of all against all, and that you need a strong government, the strong hand of the Leviathan, to control the chaos and provide safety. That, to me, is Donald Trump's version of the political community, that we are beset on all sides from danger, and that we need the strong hand of government controlled by Donald Trump in order to provide safety and stability.
And I was thinking that, of course, while Hillary Clinton and the Democrats did talk about the faults of Donald Trump during their convention in Philadelphia, it seemed like Donald Trump's language and rhetoric on Hillary Clinton was more personal, more cutting. This piece of tape I'm going to play right now is basically him portraying Hillary Clinton as corrupt.
And when a Secretary of State illegally stores her emails on a private server, deletes 33,000 of them so the authorities can't see her crime, puts our country at risk, lies about it in every different form, and faces no consequence, I know that corruption has reached a level like never, ever before in our country.
You know, if you think of a conventions in the past, usually that was the job of the keynote speaker or the vice presidential nominee to play the hitman, not so much the nominee himself.
Yeah, that's right. Donald Trump does not mind playing the hitman. And it's an interesting argument that he's making, right? I think that it's actually his best attack against Hillary Clinton. People already sort of don't trust her. And so to link her to this notion of corruption makes a lot of sense. Unfortunately for Donald Trump, I don't know that he's done the best job of making his case. certainly, you know, the emails and all of that is a good attack line. But in terms of him being able to prevent corruption or him not being corrupt himself, I think that argument is actually a little bit weak for him. In his speech, at least, you know, he sort of says, you know, I know about corruption because I took part in it, right? I paid off people. I know about the system and how it works, and so I can stop it. But he doesn't explain, you know, why he's no longer corrupt. He only says that he participated in corruption. So it's an interesting thing because on the one hand, of course, he's attacking Hillary Clinton for that. And on the other hand, he's actually admitting to being corrupt himself.
Obviously, both parties have their problems with unity. We saw that in the Republican primary party convention with Ted Cruz and the Never Trump delegates, and in Philadelphia with the Bernie Sanders delegates. But I thought Hillary Clinton made an overt effort to unite the party, unlike Donald Trump. Let me play a little bit of Hillary Clinton, her early shout out to Bernie Sanders.
I want to thank Bernie Sanders. Bernie, your campaign inspired millions of Americans, particularly the young people who threw their hearts and souls into our primary. You put economic and social justice issues front and center where they belong. And to all of your supporters here and around the country, I want you to know, I've heard you. Your cause is our cause.
I mean, obviously, that's not going to satisfy all the Bernie Sanders delegates, but at least it was a step.
Yeah, absolutely. I was actually surprised by how many appeals she made to Bernie Sanders and his supporters and his platform throughout her speech. You could really see his influence on what she said. And in some places, it ended up kind of weird. So there was one place where she said, you know, on day one, my first job is going to be to put Americans to work. And then her next sentence or her next paragraph is, we're going to do that by the Supreme Court and by getting rid of Citizens United and fixing our democracy. And then a few more paragraphs later, she said, you know, and I'm going to make the government work. I'm going to put these programs in place, get everybody to work again. And so she kind of answers the how question several paragraphs later from the beginning where she makes the argument that she's going to do this thing on day one. And it's clear that somebody, perhaps from the Sanders campaign, has inserted the Supreme Court and Citizens United thing, you know, in the intervening paragraphs. And so you kind of end up with this mismatch of policy.
Every time the camera switched to Bernie Sanders, he didn't look that happy, did he?
No, he didn't. And I think he said that that was his resting face. And I saw a thing on Twitter, I was watching on Twitter, where there were chants that were supposedly orchestrated by the Clinton folks in the arena. So if protest had erupted during her speech, that they would sort of chant certain things. And I'm not sure if that was a legitimate thing or just a thing that floated around Twitter, but I certainly heard those chants. And so I think that there was quite a bit of protest in the convention hall during her speech that they were then, you know, sort of talking over to sound supportive.
Yeah, I also heard a lot of Bernie chants from the Bernie Sanders delegates on the floor. But I also heard from both Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders delegates that the ultimate, the paramount goal of the convention and the campaign was the defeat of Donald Trump. Here's Hillary Clinton talking about the Republican nominee.
Our country's motto is E Pluribus Unum. Out of many, we are one. Will we stay true to that motto? Well, we heard Donald Trump's answer last week at his convention. He wants to divide us from the rest of the world and from each other. He's betting that the perils of today's world will blind us to its unlimited promise. He's taken the Republican Party a long way, from morning in America to midnight in America. He wants us to fear the future and fear each other. Well, you know, a great Democratic president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, came up with the perfect rebuke to Trump more than 80 years ago during a much more perilous time. The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Did you find that effective? How did you think it worked?
Well, I think that it plays well into her core commitments, which are to community and to building coalitions. And so, you know, explaining that Donald Trump is someone who wants to build a wall, who sees us, you know, as having these scary, scary people attacking us, you know, at any moment, I think that it plays to her strengths of being Secretary of State and of being knowledgeable about the international affairs and the community. And I think it appeals to those people like her who want America to be united, to be a community out of many one. So I think that it's an effective attack, yeah.
We started this conversation by talking about the different styles of Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Do you think one sounded more presidential than the other, or one made the case for his or her candidacy better than the other?
So being presidential, I think, in a nomination speech would mean that you show respect for the office, that you show respect for the democratic process that has led you to the nomination and will lead to the decision about who will become president, that you understand the history of the presidency, and that you show good judgment. I think that Hillary did a better job in all four of those things, and it's hard to now dissociate what Trump did during his speech compared to what he's done since then, where he's been sort of saying that, you know, the whole process is corrupt, and if Hillary wins in November, it's because the thing was rigged. But one major part of Hillary's speech was to talk about good judgment and empathy and what's required of leadership. And that, to me, shows presidentiality. And in fact, she was giving the criterion by which she wanted Americans to judge this election, right? And so the good leader would be the empathetic leader who has good judgment. And by that criterion, she would be that person and not Donald Trump. I thought that, you know, they both kind of tried to show respect for the office. You know, they tried to show humility a little bit. It's not natural for Donald Trump to do that. And so it came off, I think, as unnatural when he tried. But for Hillary Clinton, I thought it did seem more appropriate. So I think if I were judging, I would say that Hillary Clinton came off as more presidential during her speech, and that it was a more natural fit for her, which is so interesting because she's the first woman to make this speech and to accept this office, the nomination for this office. And so for her to just seem so natural in terms of being presidential as compared to a male candidate is really, I think, a coup for her and her speechwriters. It also shows you just how starkly divided these two candidates are in terms of temperamentality. For us to be thinking like the first female presidential nominee is the far more presidential person is a real testament to Donald Trump's campaigning style.
There's a possibility that many voters out there are hearing or heard the candidates for the first time at the conventions during their acceptance speeches. But in the end, do you get a sense that these convention acceptance speeches make a difference in November?
Well, I think that they do. I think that there are a few key moments in any presidential candidate's election season. And that, you know, aside from the debates, this acceptance speech is going to be their largest platform. And it may this year be the largest platform, depending. Of course, the NFL games are going to counter-program, so who knows who will watch. And so it's really an amazing opportunity for these candidates to speak to the entirety of the United States. There was something came out this week that said that only 9% of the American population actually voted for Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, right, in the primary process. And so they have a good number of people to persuade to vote in November. And so this was an opportunity for them to lay out their governing philosophy, for them to sort of show who they are and to let the American people imagine them in the office. And, yeah, I do think they matter.
Why do I get a sense that people would rather watch a collision between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump in a debate than a collision during an NFL game?
Well, personally, a politics nerd like myself is definitely going to be watching the debates and very interested in the outcome.
Jennifer Murcia is an associate professor of communications at Texas A&M University. She's on Twitter at J-E-N-M-E-R-C-I-E-C-A. Jennifer, it was great having you on the program.
It was absolutely my pleasure. Thank you.
Words in papers, words in books, words on TV, words for books, words of comfort, words of peace, words to make the fighting cease, words to tell you what to do, words are working hard for you. Eat your words, but don't go hungry. Words have always nearly hung me.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of our last trivia question, which was, which states currently serving senators have served together the longest? The answer, California. Both Dianne Feinstein and Barbara Boxer were first elected in 1992. Feinstein, who won a special election, was sworn in that November. Boxer, who replaced the retiring Alan Cranston, was sworn in on January 3, 1993. The two Democrats have served together ever since. The randomly selected winner is Catherine Shields of San Jose, California. Catherine wins the coveted Political Junkie button. And we have a Scuttlebutton puzzle winner as well. That's that waste of time contest where you need to take a word or concept from each button I post and then come up with a familiar saying or slogan. In our last offering before the conventions, the first button read, Goody for California. That's for Goody Knight, who served as governor in the 1950s. Then one that read, Big People for Humphrey Muskie II. Finally, a button that said, Take Off Your Shoes for Industry. That's from a Firesign Theater album.
So do your part today, Joe. Join with millions of your neighbors and turn in your shoes.
For industry.
I'll explain that at another time. So, when you combine Goody with two, with shoes, you kind of get Goody Two Shoes. And the winner is John White of Seattle, Washington. As always, check out our website for the latest campaign updates, scuttlebutton puzzles, political columns, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store. Go to krpoliticaljunkie.com.
Goody two, goody two, goody, goody two shoes. Goody two, goody two, goody, goody two shoes. Don't drink, don't smoke. What do you do? Don't drink, don't smoke. What do you do? Subtle innuendos follow. There must be something inside. Don't follow.
It's time for This Week in Political History. He was the son of a president, known as Mr. Republican. Robert A. Taft was the leading conservative of his day. In his 15 years in the Senate, starting in 1939, he headed up the forces battling first President Franklin D. Roosevelt and his New Deal, and then President Harry Truman on nearly every aspect of their foreign and domestic policies. But for all his power on Capitol Hill, Taft came up short in his three bids for his party's presidential nomination in 1940, 1948, and 1952. His third defeat to Dwight Eisenhower in 1952 was especially painful, as he was once considered the frontrunner. But with Ike's sweeping election that November, the Republicans once again took control of Congress, and Taft became Senate Majority Leader. Despite their rivalry for the nomination, Taft and Eisenhower became close allies, and Ike was looking forward to working with the new majority leader to implement his programs. But within months, it was learned that he was suffering from pancreatic cancer. And it was 63 years ago this week that Senator Robert Taft died.
In the 15 years he served in the Senate, he achieved a place in modern history that few statesmen, perhaps none save presidents, have surpassed. With flags at half-staff, the Taft family arrives for the state memorial service in the Capitol Rotunda. In a solemn farewell, plain citizens join with President and Mrs. Eisenhower in paying democracy's highest tribute to Robert Taft. Secretary of Defense Wilson joins the mourners with Ohio's Governor Frank Lausche. Resting in the place of high honor where only 12 Americans have lain in death before, Robert Alfonso Taft. A man of courage, unafraid to the very end.
In 1957, a Senate committee named Taft as one of America's five greatest senators, along with Henry Clay, Daniel Webster, John C. Calhoun, and Robert M. La Follette Sr. The Taft family in Ohio is legendary. Senator Taft's father was William Howard Taft, the 27th president, and later the Chief Justice of the United States. One of his sons, Robert Taft Jr., served in the House and Senate. His son, Bob Taft, served two terms as governor of Ohio. And Bob Taft joins us now to talk about his most distinguished family. Governor Taft, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Ken, it's great to be with you today.
I just looked this up. You know, in your family, there have been presidents and governors and senators and mayors and ambassadors and bankers and professors. Your great-great-grandfather, I didn't know this until this week, your great-great-grandfather was Attorney General and Secretary of War. But I want to tell you, you are the first Taft to appear on The Political Junkie. Now, that's history in the making right there.
Well, I'm quite honored.
Well, actually, so are we, and I really appreciate it. You know, you were only, as you know, that you were only 11 years old when your grandfather, Mr. Republican, died, but you certainly know what he meant to your family and to Ohio and to the Republican Party.
Yeah, I do have those political memories. I went to Washington when he was in the Senate. I was 8 or 9 years old and paid a visit to him and appreciated, of course, his stature to a certain extent through my family. My dad and my uncles all attended the 1952 Republican Convention. I was back in Cincinnati, but it's my first political memory because it was really the first fully televised convention. Of course, it was in black and white in those days, but I remember watching that convention where the Taft forces were edged out by the Eisenhower forces, and of course, Eisenhower went on to be elected president.
And of course, even though the two forces were so bitterly opposed to each other, I remember that amazing Everett Dirksen speech at the 52 convention that really, and Dirksen was a Taft guy, he was attacking Dewey and the Eisenhower guys, and I mean, there were bitter feelings, but when all was said and done, the party united in November, and Taft and Eisenhower became close allies.
It was quite remarkable. You know, Eisenhower made a very smart move, you know, right after he received the nomination. He called up my grandfather and said, "I want to come over and see you." My dad was there at that meeting, and they came over to the hotel, and then they went out into the lobby, and they were actually photographed together that same evening that Eisenhower won the nomination, and Taft did the best he could to say good things about Eisenhower then, and of course, you know, endorsed him wholeheartedly later. And then, as you mentioned before, Taft was the Senate leader in Washington who worked to advance the Eisenhower agenda in the Senate until his death in July.
Right. I mean, it was only like 6-7 months, and he was sick for much of it. It was not only a terrible loss for the party and the nation, but a big loss for the president, who hoped that, you know, because I think there were far more conservative forces in the Senate, and Taft was basically working with Eisenhower to implement many of his programs, right?
Exactly. He was a very strong conservative. He had concerns about excessive American involvement in the rest of the world, but he really collaborated with Eisenhower. Of course, my grandfather had his views had evolved on certain kinds of federal programs. For example, he had later in his career in the Senate, he'd supported a limited federal aid to education and also a federal aid to housing. So he felt there was a role for the federal government in those kinds of social programs, even though he was a fiscal conservative on the budget and was concerned about an overreaching federal government in general.
You know, you talk about these federal programs that your grandfather supported. I remember, I remember reading that, I don't know if it was Senator Bricker of Ohio or somebody said that your grandfather had socialist leanings or
yeah, you know, there was the Tea Party type sentiment back even in those days, and my grandfather was willing to, I think, evolve with the times as he saw needs would arise.
When most people think of your grandfather, one of the things they think of most is the Taft-Hartley Act in 1947 that sought to curb the power of the labor unions. I have a little piece of tape from your grandfather. Here he is defending the legislation.
The Taft-Hartley Act was written for only one purpose: to restore justice and equality in labor management relations. It was not a new law, but a revision of elaborate existing laws, such as the Wagner Act and the Norris-Lagarde Act, which were so one-sided that they conferred on labor union leaders arbitrary power over all but the largest employers, and even more important, over all of their employees.
I've heard him give many speeches. He was Mr. Republican, but he wasn't Mr. Charisma. Is that a fair?
Absolutely not. I think that hurt him a lot in his quest for the presidency. He was a very strong legislative leader. He really dominated the Senate with his knowledge of details. And this was before there were huge staffs operating up there on Capitol Hill. but the Taft-Hartley Act was really a rebalancing of the labor laws of the country, and they really stood the test of time. I mean, pretty much the labor laws we have today are those that were enacted in the amendments under the Taft-Hartley Act. So he had substance, he had knowledge, he was obviously, you know, a very intelligent, commanding figure on Capitol Hill in terms of policy and substance. But no, he wasn't too charismatic. I've got campaign photos, supposedly campaign photos, of him, the hunting photo, and he's in a three-piece suit.
It reminds me of Richard Nixon walking on the beach in a suit, right? Barefoot, but in a wearing a suit, right?
Yeah, exactly. He wasn't too good at kind of letting loose and going with the campaign flow.
Well, but, you know, you could also say, I mean, everybody said that he also stood for principle. And, you know, I know he was an outspoken critic of the Nuremberg trials, and it's not that he defended the Nazis, but he said that the trials were more about vengeance and not justice. It wasn't a popular stand to take, but it was principled.
That was absolutely remarkable. That landed him a chapter in John F. Kennedy's Profiles in Courage, but it's remarkable that someone who aspired to be president of the United States, you know, shortly before he ran for president, would make a speech, you know, critical of the Nuremberg trials, and he was basing it on U.S. law. He thought it was a violation of U.S. Constitutional law based on we don't have ex post facto laws where we make up a crime, you know, after the crime has been committed. So it was somewhat technical and legalistic in his approach, but politically very damaging.
Let me switch to you for a second. If you're born with the name Bob Taft and your great-grandfather was president and your grandfather and father were both senators, it's pretty safe to assume you know what line of business you're going to go into.
Well, my dad was, as you mentioned, a U.S. senator, and I remember him campaigning. In fact, in 1970, when he was campaigning for the nomination for the U.S. Senate against former Governor Jim Rhodes, I hit the campaign trail for Dad. So I knew from personal experience what I was getting into with politics, and I enjoy the policy and the governing, you know, a lot more than the politics and the campaigning. But I like people, and I enjoyed traveling Ohio, and so I could do both. I think we need more folks who will do both and who will think about running for office, both at the local level, the state level, and also for president. There's a lot of, I think, very qualified people who would be really good presidents, but they don't run because the campaigns are so daunting.
Although when you graduated college, I guess you went to Yale, yes? Yale?
Correct.
And when you graduated, you served in the Peace Corps in Tanzania, is that correct?
Yeah, I was inspired to go overseas, and I wanted to travel, and I served as a school teacher in Tanzania for 2 years, which gave me a lifelong interest in education.
What was your first political campaign as a candidate?
I ran for the Ohio State Legislature back in 1976. We kind of work our way up in our family. You know, we don't just start at the top. Like my dad and my grandfather, you know, they both started in the Ohio State Legislature, and that's what I did. And I worked my way up from a state rep to a county commissioner to Secretary of State of Ohio and then to governor.
So you served two terms as governor. What do you think was your best accomplishment, your proudest moment was?
We invested a lot in education and also brought in an era where we would ask accountability of the schools in terms of high academic standards and results. That was important. We also had a very high-tech initiative to create more high-tech jobs in Ohio, which was pretty successful, called the Third Frontier Project. And then we negotiated an agreement to protect the Great Lakes with all the other Great Lakes states and Ontario and Quebec, an agreement, interstate compact, to protect the waters of the Great Lakes from being diverted elsewhere in the world.
And you're now involved with the University of Dayton?
I'm teaching at the University of Dayton. I teach, of course, no surprise, all about legislative politics. I teach about the U.S. Congress, where my ancestors served, but I never wanted to go myself because I love state government. And then I teach a course on education policy and work with our, when we send student interns to state government in Columbus and also up to Washington. So I'm really enjoying that. And fortunately, I don't have to be too involved in politics unless I really want to today.
Let me ask you a question about your daughter, Anna. It doesn't sound like she plans to go into electoral politics, does it?
No, but she's doing wonderful work throughout the world. She started a small foundation to do health care and scholarships in Ecuador and community development projects in a country called Mali in West Africa. So she's doing really good work, and I don't think she ever will be going into politics, although you never know. I seriously doubt it.
Does that mean this is the end of the Taft dynasty?
It's probably enough, you know, starting with my great-great-grandfather all the way through me. I think that's probably enough generations for now.
Did you know that I went to William Howard Taft High School in the Bronx? I thought I'd just
throw that in. Lots of Taft High Schools. There's even a Robert A. Taft High School down in Cincinnati. So they're all over the place, and I feel very fortunate to be part of a family that has a long career of public service, and I certainly enjoyed my role in Ohio, especially the opportunity to serve as governor of Ohio.
Yeah, I tell people I went to Taft High School when Taft was still president.
I don't think you're quite that old.
No, thank you. Governor Taft, it was a pleasure having you on the program.
Thanks a lot, Ken. It's going to be a fascinating year in a horrible sort of way, but we got to stay tuned, and we'll see what happens.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Ken.
Bob Taft is the former two-term governor of Ohio. It was 63 years ago this week, on July 31st, 1953, that his grandfather, Senate Majority Leader Robert A. Taft, Mr. Republican, one of the greatest senators in our nation's history, died of cancer. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie.
It's a family affair.
It's a family affair.
Before we go, one last note about the controversy between Donald Trump and the Khan family. On Wednesday, one day before Mr. Khan addressed the Democratic Convention, I spoke with Mike Safey, a Clinton delegate from San Bernardino, California. San Bernardino, of course, is the site where, in December of 2015, a married couple of the Muslim faith killed 14 people and seriously injured 22 more. During the attack, the husband declared their allegiance to the Islamic State. The delegate I mentioned earlier, Mike Safey, is a Muslim. Here's part of my conversation with him in Philadelphia. We've been covering politics for a long, long time. I don't remember anybody talking about Muslim Americans as they are in 2016. Do you find yourself under a certain microscope with the attacks and with the rhetoric from the other side?
Absolutely true, especially when you have a national leader who comes and strokes the faith, he strokes on bigotry, he strokes about the Muslim bashing, and not only we saw from Donald Trump, we also saw from Ted Cruz as well, and then quite a few other Republican leaders we saw. I think it becomes much easier scapegoat, let's blame Muslims and get vote. And one part they do not understand that Muslim phenomena is not new. Muslim phenomena is not about the refugee. Muslim phenomena is not last decades. There has been Muslims in this country from 18th century. We are the core fabric of this nation. And to someone come and say, well, we're going to bar Muslims and we're going to ban Muslims. Muslims come from all shape, all forms, all ethnic backgrounds, and in all different colors.
What do you hear from your community when you see a presidential candidate using an ethnic group, a religious group, to further his political... I mean, I can't recall. I mean, maybe there was anti-Catholic sentiment and rhetoric in 1960 when John F. Kennedy ran, but I can't remember any attacks on religion since 1960.
The rhetoric has become more, and perhaps maybe social media and with the media, and especially at the national level, when you have a political candidate who comes openly and he says, you know what, let's make America great again by banning Muslims. And I try to read the fine lines when Donald Trump says, well, let's make America great again. To me, his fine lines are, okay, so we were going to bring a slavery back. We're going to have a segregation in this country. We're going to build a wall, 16 feet top, 16 feet bottom, deport all the Hispanics communities, bar all Muslims coming, and perhaps making a simply a KKK or a white land. Is that what he means when he says he's going to make America great again? To him, my message is America is already great. We are a diverse nation, and in the last 30 years, yes, we are a diverse nation, and we have grown diverse nation. And that's our values, and that's even made our foundation more stronger.
Not that you can speak for the Muslim community, but do you find the community more pessimistic and withdrawn in the wake of these attacks, or do you see a sense of optimism?
Well, I see that we are very alienated. I see some pessimism because the Muslim voice on the national media is very unheard of. There are organizations like CARE, they're trying to do their best. Every time their attacks happen, they come and they try to have a conferences. And what I think, or what I can speak on behalf of Muslims, that we as a community needs to come out more. We need to have a better media outlet. We need to come and speak to people like you and be on the national media and not only denounce those attacks and let the people know, look, it has nothing to do with their religion. And we are the core fabric of this nation. We are doctors, we are lawyers, we are business owners, we are public servants. We are everywhere. We are just like everyone.
We are delegates to the convention.
And we are delegates to the convention. That's right.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was Mike Safey, a delegate from San Bernardino, California, and a Muslim. I spoke to him last week at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia.
Now I've been happy lately, thinking about the good things to come, and I believe it could be something good has begun. Oh, I've been smiling lately, dreaming about the world at one, and I believe it could be someday it's going to come. 'Cause out on the edge of darkness, there rides a peace train. Oh, peace train, take this country. Come take me home again.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
Come and join the living. It's not so far from you. And it's getting nearer. Soon it will all be true. Oh, peace train sounding louder.